There's something very important I forgot to tell you.
What?
Don't cross the streams.
Why?
It would be bad.
I'm fuzzy on the whole good-bad thing. What do you mean bad?
Try to imagine all life as you know it stopping instantaneously and every molecule in your body exploding at the speed of light.
Total protonic reversal.
All right, that's bad. Okay.
Welcome to the Fourth Forward Podcast.
To the Port Forward Podcast, episode number 15, Is It Time to Start Up? In this episode, we're going to talk startups and tech conferences. Ben's, I forgot what I was going to say.
Hashtag winning.
I had an amusing thing to add to it, and then I forgot it. Anyway, just say Ben's hashtag winning streak.
I'm going to touch very briefly upon the moral and ethical quandaries of a warm body being better than a cold body. And then after that, something on the more serious, logical, and maybe even informational side of things on algorithmic time complexity.
We'll talk about the direction of the podcast, of the show, and we'll also finish up with some NoSQL database called Redis. So, let's get the show started. Today is Thursday, September 29, 2011. We're back. Woo woo. What's up, Ben?
Hey, Merrick. How's it going? So today looks like we don't have Sam, but it's just going to be Merrick and I today. Hopefully, maybe Sam will come online. We're not really sure where he's at right now. But today is podcast number 15. We haven't been at this for a while. We forgot that we had a podcast, right, Merrick? And then
it's a little weird because we're like, we feel like we should be doing something. And
there's something
sitting around the house. I don't know.
Something that I'm supposed to be doing right now. It's like that thought in the back of your head.
That's funny. So we have quite a bit of feedback and quite a lot of things have happened since our last podcast. To briefly cover feedback so we can jump into the topics in the show, Neil, our longtime fan, listener, and guest, one-time guest, awesome guy, he commented on a previous post about Ben had a question about a accelerometer or gyroscope measuring.
So I believe that I had actually used the term gyroscope, but I was actually talking about accelerometers. And the question from show number 14 was, can a 3D accelerometer or gyroscope measure the acceleration of the Earth? And the answer is actually yes, which is pretty awesome. These little accelerometer chips are manufactured with something called MEMS. Usually I call that MEMS. And I'm going to look that up really quick because I forgot what that meant. There we go. Micro electromechanical systems. So basically what this is on the little silicon chip, what they do is they literally burn little like gears and structures that do physical things, like something you would think of in like an engine or like in a gearbox, that are actually able to manufacture this using silicon inside the chip. And so one of the things that they do is they are able to create three different accelerometers for each, the X, Y, and the Z, and they the silicon has physical properties, which is pretty cool.
That's awesome. It's hard to even imagine, a physical device that small working and doing its thing inside your cell phone, even though it's doing it all the time. That's pretty cool.
And so there's I'm sorry to cut you off. There's an app that I have buried away in a folder somewhere here for my iPhone. It's called X Sensor. And when you fire this up, it lets you basically get a bar graph output of your accelerometer. And you can see that if you hold the phone in one direction, like if I'm holding my phone flat on the table, the Z-axis shows up as -1g, basically, right? Because that's -1 gravity. And then nice. If you hold the phone perfectly vertical, like you're looking at it, then the Y has -1g and the other ones go to zero. So you should definitely check out that app in the App Store. Once again, it's called X Sensor.
It'd be sweet to test out, the accelerometers in your phone. Maybe, get on one of those Virgin Galactic space flights and just see what they max out at. That'd be kind of fun, I think.
Definitely.
That's cool.
Neil have anything else that he'd said there that was interesting for us?
Neil is awesome enough that he types massive cool comments, and that's why we want to keep our show awesome, is to keep Neil happy. So I think, Neil, if we did skip over some of your stuff, we're sorry about that, and we will cover it either on the website or in a future show.
Neil also says, "Don't cross the streams," which of course is our favorite reference from
Ghostbusters. I had to look it up, and I felt bad because it seems like I've seen it like twice since I looked it up. So I wonder how long have I been missing that like joke? And seriously, movie quotes is something that I'm like, I like to be on point about that. So I'm a little disappointed in myself. I failed you, listeners. I failed you. I won't do it again.
Oh, man. So we also have some feedback from Quentin, who basically was commenting about version control systems back in the day when, he was using Digital's VAX/VMS operating system, which apparently has the issue with the versioning control where it creates new copies of the files and doesn't use smart versioning or doesn't use smart diffing to save you on space. And he had another question about WEP versus WPA and why WEP was so piss poor. And I'd actually like to save this feedback for when Sam's on the line, either later or next show, so Sam and I can bitch about WEP.
Sounds good.
So, Merrick, what have we been doing since the last podcast? What has just been going on in all this whole time?
A crazy ton amount of shit. In our last show, we did cover iOS Dev Camp, which was kind of like my de-virginization for, tech conferences and hackathons. I'd heard of these things before, and I'd not been. And so I went with you to that, and it was awesome. Check the last show. And since then, I've been trying to get into as many of these events as possible, just because I'm loving it. The major ones we've hit since then are
Cloudy 2011, TwilioCon, and then we all went together as a podcast. And then the last one, which is the HTML5 hackathon, I actually went to by myself. But before we get too deep into this, apparently Sam got his fucking act together and has signed online. So I think that we will come online with Sam now.
Sounds good. Let's see what we can do.
Jello.
All right, guys. What's up?
What's shaking?
Welcome to the Port Forward Podcast again. This is show 15, as we mentioned earlier. And guess what? Sam's on the line now.
Hey, Sam. How's it going?
Not too bad. How are you guys doing?
Just fine. So, Sam, we were about to talk about all the different things we've been doing, but I'd actually like to backtrack just a little bit. we had some feedback from a listener, Quentin, and he asked, he says, for a future topic, can you explain the differences between the different Wi-Fi encryption standards and why WEP is supposed to be so bad that iOS doesn't officially support it according to our local Apple reseller?
All right.
Any feedback on that, Sam?
I'm still curious on how it is that they don't officially support it, since...
I think that he might actually be misinformed, and that the Apple retailer might... Or maybe the Apple... Actually, you know what? It's probably the Apple genius that doesn't know what the fuck they're talking about.
Wait. Are you telling me that an Apple genius doesn't know everything there is to know about everything?
About the entire internet?
Even though they are a genius? Air quotes. You couldn't see that, listeners.
Well, they don't allow WEP for the tethering thing, which is, you know, obviously a good thing. But maybe that's what he's referring to.
Maybe that's what he was talking about.
Yeah, makes sense.
Well, anyway. Ben, do you know the difference between WPA and WPA2?
No, but let's just talk about WEP versus WPA.
Okay.
So the problem with WEP is they are using... I actually don't know the exact kind of... cipher there? Oh, yeah, they're using RC4. So RC4 is a kind of hashing encryption algorithm. And I have this web page here, and I'm just going to read like a little sentence right here. It says, WEP uses the RC4 encryption algorithm, which is known as a stream cipher. A stream cipher operates by expanding a short key into an infinite pseudo-random key stream. The sender XORs the key stream with the plain text to produce ciphertext. The receiver has a copy of the same key and uses it to generate the identical key stream. XORing the key stream with a ciphertext yields a plain text. And here's the next paragraph. This mode of operation makes stream ciphers vulnerable to several attacks. If the attacker flips a bit in the ciphertext, then upon decryption, the corresponding bit in plain text will also be flipped. Also, if an eavesdropper intercepts two ciphertexts encrypted with the same key stream, it's possible to obtain an XOR of the two plain texts. Knowledge of this XOR can enable statistical attacks to recover the plain text. This statistical attack becomes increasingly practical as more ciphertexts that use the same key stream are known. Once one of the plain texts becomes known, it's trivial to recover all others. Mm-hmm. So basically what they're saying is because they're using this method of XORing on top, you can do a statistical attack against to recover the original WEP key.
Right. And then you finish off the whole attack using brute force.
Right. So you basically, Sam and I ran this against Sam's home router. When I first started hanging out with Sam, I was like, oh, Sam's this cool like technology guy. And then I was asking about like, oh, you know, what's your home password? Because I was hanging out at his house. What's a password on your Wi-Fi? And I was like, oh, it's a WEP network. Are you insane? He's like, oh, it's fine. It's some long character thing. I was like, no, let me break it down for you and show you how easy it is to hack into your own network. And yeah, we did, right?
Very quickly, I might add.
That's awesome.
So I think if you're using 64-bit, you only need like 100,000 packets, which can take something around 15 minutes to generate. Basically, there's a couple tools. If you're really interested in web cracking, you can look it up yourself. We talked about it a little bit on a previous podcast. I don't remember which one. But basically, you send a packet over and over, and the router responds with a unique response to your packet. And if you get 100,000 of these responses, then you can do this XOR statistical attack to recover the key. So it uses statistics on top of brute force to basically get the key within like seconds, honestly. After you wait 15 minutes of collecting data, it takes like 10 seconds to crack. And then if you're using 128-bit WEP, you need something like 600,000 or 800,000 packets, and then the attack, once again, the attack takes like under a minute. So
right. The thing with me is that nobody ever updated me. The first router I ever got, WEP was the only option, and it never really made sense to me why you ended up with that hash as the password, and you couldn't just make your own password unless, but you know, I just let it go since I didn't know any better, and nobody ever said, hey, you should probably stop using that.
So there are ways of using RC4 correctly, but basically the way that these guys made it was very, they did a very poor implementation. And so basically the key is leaked. The more packets that you see, the more that the key is leaked. WPA uses a more advanced technology, which does not leak keys like that. Also, WPA, I believe, it runs the hash or the encryption function 2,000 times. Now, you might think, well, that doesn't really help you because if you know the password, you just know the password or whatever, but it makes brute force 2,000 times harder. So that basically prevents you from just brute forcing WPA because it takes forever because they have like a lot of work that the CPU needs to do.
I'm with you.
There is an upside to the lameness of this security. If you live in a population-dense area and your neighbors happen to, you know, be running WEP, then you can just go ahead and crack it and get free internet. So
yes, which is, of course, illegal. So we don't recommend that you guys do that. I'm pretty sure that that is extremely illegal. And if you would like to maybe change their network to WPA2, well, that would be up to your own. You know, I wouldn't suggest doing that either, but maybe you could secure their network for them. That's probably the only way that I could condone you breaking
their
network.
But then you would lock them out.
Of course. I forgot to mention, listeners, I'm in countries where this is legal is where you would do this. If you live in a population dense area where it's legal to crack into your neighbor's network, then yes, that's something you can do to get free internet. But, you know, I guess check your local county ordinances and regulations before you proceed.
But you would lock them out, though.
All right,
I'm
so.
I'm just saying. You'd lock them out, Ben, if you're logged in.
Yeah, I know you'd lock them out. But if, you know, okay, then print on their printer, print them a message on how to do it. It's, you know, whatever.
That would be quite nice.
Or just lolcats. You could just start printing lolcats out.
Right, or you could just start printing black pages and just kill their ink cartridge. You know, whatever you want.
That's funny.
Sidetrack. Have you guys heard about the facts of death? It's pretty awesome. You find some organization that you don't support, and you take three pieces of black paper, or three pieces of paper you like, you know, printed out black, and you fax. You start a fax to this person that you don't like, and you basically tape the three pieces of paper in a roll, so they just feed through your fax machine like in a loop, just faxing them black paper.
Oh, that's terrible.
I think that would also be. That is terrible. So we left off before Sam fucking, you know, interrupted our awesome two-man podcast.
Glorious. It was glorious.
So, Merrick, where have we been?
Oh, we've been busy. Ever since iOS Dev Camp, we've been hitting lots of different hackathons and these, I guess you would call them tech conferences or shows. And there's a surprising amount that goes down in our area, but
which
at
is the
same
Bay Area,
time,
which is, you know, California,
yeah,
San Francisco.
At the same time, if you live in a highly populated area, I'm almost positive these same events are going down in your spot. And you, as a resource, I've been using PlanCast, Eventbrite, and Meetup. And out of those three, I do like Eventbrite and PlanCast more. It seems I can find more relevant, you know, stuff to my interests. Events.
So if you didn't get that, go ahead and rewind your podcaster. That would be PlanCast, Eventbrite, and what was the third one?
Meetup.
So basically those are all, you should all do Google searches on all of those, and we will put those in the show notes.
Definitely.
And basically you can subscribe to your area, and you can you can say things like, oh, I'd like tech, or oh, I like, you know, sports or whatever, and they will basically give you events that, you know, cater to what you need.
Yeah, you can be as specific as you want or as general as you want, and there's a surprising amount of these things going down, so it's actually a pretty good resource.
So, first thing on the list was Cloudy, 2011. So what was Cloudy about, anyone?
It was a interesting little get-together hosted by, well, CloudE, and they have
ProSoftNet.
Yeah, ProSoftNet. It's one of ProSoftNet's products, I guess, out of their handful of products.
It was iBackup, right?
Yeah, iBackup and I forget what it's called, iRemote PC? Can't recall.
So if you're curious, you can definitely search them. And we found out about this event through one of those websites we just told you, and they had quite a nice spread. They had a couple speakers. I was not there on time, so I think I missed the first speaker or so, but were you guys there on time at the start?
Yes, we were there on time, right, Sam?
Yeah. The first speaker was a guy from, I think it was Alchemy Communications. Wasn't that him? Were you there for that?
I can't believe you remember that. I have no idea.
Oh. Well, I remember because he had all these data centers, and it was, you know, it sounded extremely expensive.
Oh, because Sam wants his bandwidth nuts. You want his nuts for the bandwidth, right?
desperately need all the, as much bandwidth
yes,
as I could possibly get.
Give me all the bandwidth that you have. So basically, what they had this conference together, and they basically were releasing their new API. So their API lets you back up any files to the cloud. It has a public and private key as well as a password. So basically, you get your public-private key pair, you know, paired up with the service. You have a password, and they basically have Linux. Linux command line tools that you can run, so you can basically any image or anything you want to backup, you just put up in the cloud. So if you had like your VDI, your virtual disks on your whatever virtualization you were using, or your VHD disks or whatever, The idea was that you could throw those straight up to the cloud. And I believe they had hooks ready to go with not Zen Server. They didn't support Zen Server, but they did support VMware, which is the more popular, right? And so they had this little competition, this little contest. And they said, if you can come up with a good use of our API, go ahead and tweet it, and the winners will get an iPod Nano.
And this was at the Cloud E event. They were having
this at the Cloud E event, right?
Informal little, quasi hackathon thing.
And so, right. And so this reinforced to me that the value of Twitter. So of course, I got to work making an idea, and I tweeted it. And then I got to work making an idea for Sam, and we tweeted it.
Your idea was actually pretty cool. They not only, even though you slammed it together, the guy when he was announcing, the winners, he commented on that, your idea actually being cool and if people should check it out online. So tell us about, what you made.
So basically, there is this software for Linux, and it's called Tripwire. And what Tripwire does in a single install is you install Tripwire on your server, and it basically keeps hashes of all the configuration files for all the services you're running. So if someone hacks in and then decides that they're going to change your SSH config so that root would be allowed to log in, well, Tripwire will send you an email immediately and say, you had changes on your box, which is great because if you're working on the box and you see those emails, then you know that it came from you. But if you're chilling on the beach in Hawaii and you see emails like that, then you know that some shit's going down. But the problem with Tripwire is that if someone gets full compromised on your box, and they know that Tripwire is a thing, the first thing that they can do is they can turn off Tripwire email notifications and just turn Tripwire all the way off. And if they know to do that first, then they can pawn your box because then you won't know and they'll have time to get, their hooks, set deep into your operating system.
All right. Sorry, we have to distract level depth. One or two or whatever phase we're at right now because this is something that bugs me. I've lost sleep over it. And I've heard the characters on South Park pronounce that word that way before, and that that aside, I like ownage or own, and even though there's a P there, I can't or will not pronounce that P. And
you can't say pawned.
I won't do it. No.
You were first exposed to this on South Park?
No.
It wasn't on the internet.
Pure Ownage was my first exposure. It was this funny little web TV show type thing where these Canadian guys just get together and do random stupid shit, and it's actually pretty hilarious, and I forgot it existed till just now.
And, me too. Thanks.
And it's seriously, without me knowing the exact history of how the P came into that, I have a feeling it's just a keyboard thing. I want to vote now. I'm placing my vote that we don't use the P.
Okay.
For ownage.
That sounds good.
To own a box or to be owned or to represent pure ownage, those are all things that could happen. Seriously, I'm not saying this like you guys can't do it. It's just like, I don't know why. It's like one of those teeny little pet peeves I have. So sorry, I had to say that. Let's go right back to where we were, back to distraction depth. And
So the first scenario is that the guy's pawned your box.
God damn
and
it.
And he turns off Tripwire.
Son of a bitch. All right, keep going.
So the first thing he does is he turns off Tripwire so you don't get those notification emails that your server has been owned. I'll say it like that. So what my little solution using their backup solution was... basically, let's say you have 10 VMs or 10 servers or whatever, and they're all being backed up under iBackup. The idea is that you have an 11th server that is on a different LAN, it's on a different location, it's running from your home, like whatever. It needs to be separate from these 10 VMs on the network. And the idea is that this 11th machine will go to the backups and pull all of the log files out of the backups for the 10 machines and then run Tripwire. So basically what that means is that you are running Tripwire on the files outside of where the hacker might have owned the box. So when he logs into the box, he doesn't know that Tripwire is running, because the way these backups work usually is that the remote machine, whatever machine's running backups, will do an asset, will remotely log into the target machine and pull the data off of it. So there's no software, the backup is not running on the target machine, it's running on another machine somewhere else, and it's being pulled off. So basically this prevents the hacker from turning off Tripwire, because he can't even get access to that CPU. He would have to hack some other totally random remote LAN that he doesn't even know about in order to get at the Tripwire. So that was my little suggestion, and we drew up a little, I drew it up on a piece of paper and I took a picture of it and we put it up on my Twitter account. And basically my Twitter account, I'm using the show's Twitter account, which is PortFWDPodcast. Please follow me on Twitter. And you can look back and you can actually see our entry into this. And I ended up winning first place. So I won a cool little Nano, and then I won a wristwatch, which was the Kickstarter, right? Right, Merrick?
Yeah.
The Kickstarter project?
I think, I don't remember if it's called the TikTok or something like that, but the story of this company is they had this cool
TikTok.
There you go, TikTok. They had this cool idea. They're going to make a watch band for the iPod Nano, and it's like a rubber band that actually just cradles the Nano, and then all of a sudden you have this Nano as a wristwatch. And the Nano is a cool little thing, and the idea is a cool thing, but the way they got funded was on Kickstarter, which is a crowdsourced funding website, and it's very cool. I was skeptical when I went on there first, because I'm like, well, what are they doing, and, you know, what are they taking for exchange, and you know, pimping whatever here, and from what I could tell after researching on the website, they actually don't ask for or take anything of your idea, company, project, startup, whatever you want to call it. You can get on this, and you want to... Presentation's important, obviously. If you slam some shit together, people are going to be like, you're dumb, we're not funding that. But you put some effort into a presentation on this website for your idea, company, whatever, and then it's put in front of... I'm sure a large user base, because I've seen this, it's been in multiple, you know, media outlet stories and, you know, news blogs, whatever. And so people...
What was that? Blogs.
And so people...
Have you put one together yet, Merrick?
I want to for my... Let's see, project, we're just going to call it... All right, listeners, don't steal my idea or I'm pissed. It's Stereo Cooler. And it's a stereo in a cooler. Get it? No, really, it's awesome. I know that sounds weird at first, but I'll
Distraction depth plus one. Yeah. Dude, I floated the American River. Do you know how many stereo coolers I saw, Merrick?
Yeah, all of these dudes built it, but none of them are freaking selling them, all right? They just have
their
stereo
cooler. All right, okay, you're right.
So if I go into production and this thing shows up at Walmart for $100, people are stoked on it.
Oh, all the rednecks are
exactly,
stoked, dude.
Exactly, and then I can start my exotic car collection. So, Listeners, if you want to jump in on this project, you're welcome. Just put some work in. Anyway, back to Kickstarter. So, you craft a presentation, put some effort into it, and then your idea gets, you know, kind of put out for the world to test. And the mechanics is you choose a number of funding you need raised, be it 50 grand, 100 grand, 10 grand, some arbitrary cash amount that you need to get your thing off the ground. And people can choose to donate a small amount towards that. And you kind of pick the small amount, I think, too. And
yeah, you get to set the different donation levels.
Exactly.
And then you can basically give them a name. So basically, you know, you've got your basic contributors, you've got, hey, that's cool, you know, it's like, you know, it's like the fucking Cold Stone sizes on the ice cream. It's like it, love it, gotta have it. It's like, you know, you can set it up.
Yeah, and for these different levels, you also, I mean, what I've seen before and it has been met with success is people get something or get some kind of, you know, advantage for, you know, funding.
I have an example
on
if you're when you're done.
Yeah, go for it.
So what I saw was it was an iPhone app, and basically it was an app to help you run. And it generated ambient sounds while you're running to sort of stimulate you and to running. And basically what it was a zombie survival game. And so I suppose they would make like zombie noises, like they were chasing you or something. And then like on the map, you had like objectives, like you could go to like a health objective or you could go to like a safe spot and stuff like that. And then it looked like a really, really cool running game. Where, you know, just something to kind of get you pumped while you're, you know, jogging in whatever, you know, wherever you were. It would just kind of give you like a GPS something or other. And so they were offering like T-shirts. And then if you donated over $350, I think, you got to be a full character. So they would make a full character in the zombie iPhone running game that was you, you know, as your face or whatever, and you got to choose, like, the bio and the history and stuff on this character, you know, whatever you wanted. It was really cool.
That's cool. So, yeah, back to the TikTok example. Their product was small enough and simple enough where they, I don't know the number they had to hit, but they said, if you donate $50, that's like you pre-ordering this watch band, I should call it, and people loved it. You know, a shitload of people got on there. They not only met their funding goal, they went way over it, which is possible.
Like, way over.
So, you know, they became a company, they started selling the shit out of these watch bands, and now they're stoked on money. So that's how Kickstarter works. It's awesome. If you're curious about it, check out the website, kickstarter.com, I assume. I have no idea if that's the actual website. But it's an awesome idea. I love the idea of crowdsourced anything. So I don't know why that seems so cool to me, but it just is.
So the next thing we went to was TwilioCon. Merrick, you want to explain what Twilio is and kind of what they offer?
Yeah, Twilio kind of came out of the woodwork for me, even though they've been around and have a little bit of history. This was their first event, and they kind of have been plunged into the media, at least from my perspective. I'm sure people, you know, I've heard of them before, but they are a cloud communications platform. They offer very simple, straightforward, easy-to-use APIs for both SMS text messaging, video calls, regular voice calls, and, you know, just like a cloud communications platform. That pretty much sums it up. And I have limited experience with APIs. Like, I've interfaced with, you know, Netflix and a different communications provider, but from what I've seen before, their APIs are super straightforward, and you can slam an app together fairly quickly. And if you want text messaging, voice calls, or some mashup thereof, you know, with
and also it'll
else.
Also read out. You also have computer aided like reading out.
Oh,
and stuff.
Yeah.
So you could have it like read like a wake up call,
like phone tree, like you know when you call one of your companies that you hate and you're like, I want to talk to someone. The machine's like, I'm sorry, there's no one you can talk to available right now. You are number 472 in line.
You like that shit, right? So do you want to say what your idea was? I mean, you never worked on this, Merrick, but do you want to, or does that kind of on the DL?
We're saying, oh, no. We can talk about my service, but we should, I feel like, is I don't know. We're just in the middle of all the reviews of everything else. So
okay.
I'll touch on it briefly.
Okay, well, here's we forgot a couple of things. First off, we forgot to mention what we won, and then we forgot to mention the food.
Crap, we're still on Cloudy, too. We're not even freaking talking about... Oh, all right, so, we'll jump back to Cloudy real quick. The food
is just for those two things. So first,
amazing.
Let's start with the food.
Yeah.
And what scale are we going to use for the food? Out of 5, out of 10, what are we using?
Let's rate these events. I think food's simple enough where we can do it out of 5. And
okay.
For context, let's say 5 is like Z-O-M-G, however you pronounce that. This is the most fucking amazing food I've ever had in my life. And... Zero is like you walked into your kitchen and you put like salami on a piece of bread and ate it. That's zero.
Yes. Zero.
So the food, I'm going to give the food at Cloudy a 4 because it was the best conference food I've ever had in my life. And out of all the weddings I've been to, which usually...
I'm going to give it a 5, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe I'm just being pretentious or whatever, but I give it a 5.
I understand.
Sam?
Was pretty amazing.
I'm definitely going with 5. That was some upscale stuff.
It was. And just for a little bit of detail, and in case you think we eat like homeless people and you're not sure what our reference, our frame of reference is here, they had, you know, a professional wait staff like lined up on both sides of this hall, and they
It was at the Four Seasons Hotel, right? So uppity style hotel, right?
It was a very high class place overall, and they had, I don't even remember the names of the dishes. It's like you can't pronounce it because it's, you know, when you're used to eating normal people food, it's like, oh yeah, I know what's good, and then all of a sudden you go into like a 5-star restaurant and you're like, what the fuck is this shit on
or
the
jelly
menu?
Beans like at the iOS dev camp.
Yeah, if that's what you're used to for a snack, you go to this
thing. That's what I was expecting since, you know, we had just gotten back however long it was since then, you know.
A variety of, like, whatever you call it, the before the main course, these little pre-courses, or, you know, in a multi-course meal, these little vegetable amazing type dishes with random kind of crazy shit in it with all the fancy stuff. And
it was like a food cooking show is what you would see.
So next time
like
you're watching Food Channel and you're like, oh my God, that looks amazing. That's kind of what they were doing here.
And what did we win at Cloudy? We won 2 iPod Nanos, and I won first place with the Kickstarter TikTok band. And then Sam got just the iPod Nano. And then we were going to get Merrick to win as well, but we just ran out of time.
Too late in the game.
Which is really interesting because the amount of the people that were attending this Cloudy thing were like more business exec types that they, you know, maybe they ran their own servers or they basically were business type people. They didn't really know what was going on and they didn't know how to think on their feet. They didn't know how to like, you know,
or they didn't care about winning an iPod Nano. Take your pick.
A couple people had some good examples, but they were like, I want to back up my iPhone contacts.
Yeah.
Like that was their example. And I gave like a full fucking diagram with servers and circles and squares and lines.
Squiggly lines. For the win.
For the win, okay?
So Cloudy, awesome food, interesting stuff, cool cloud communications platform.
Merrick?
Whoa. Merrick? He just got murdered.
He just got fucking dropped.
Oh, well. They also gave us hard drives. And they gave you two.
Oh, yeah, they gave
us
hard drives. That was really nice. So they gave us 300 gig hard drives. And since I won first place, I managed to sucker the chick into giving me two hard drives.
If you listen to the podcast, you guys say, hey, I didn't get suckered. I'm not a chick. Thank you very much. Merrick's still connected, it looks like.
Yeah, so let's go ahead and resolve this connection issues before we fucking continue the podcast. Okay. Is that all right with you, audience out there? Should we keep going without Merrick? Anyone want to vote?
Should we just leave him in? He's probably still talking to himself.
He's probably still talking.
I guess we can't wait for the audience to decide.
Well, we are on a podcast.
We are. All right. I guess we'll do a pause.
All right, well, the audience has voted. We're keeping Merrick. All right. Hello? Man. Welcome to Podcast Tech Hell. All right, guys, we're going to put this on pause and we'll come back.
Jumble.
Hey, Merrick just called me. Hey, Merrick. Dude, his mic probably died.
Does it have battery power?
Yeah, it does.
That sucks.
That would suck.
I'm really quite fond of my mic that you
What's
get
up, guys?
With this phone.
Hey, what happened?
Yep, my headset totally died. You guys totally called it. So it sucks because like I was like talking and then like it was quiet and I'm like, yeah, hey guys, welcome to the podcast. How's it going? So what's up, guys? And, anyway, you know the rest of the story. So is my volume okay right now?
Everything's fine. Let's fucking power through it and keep going.
All right, let's do it.
So food is a 5, and we won the iPod Nanos, and we're ready to talk about TwilioCon. You ready?
Let's do it.
So, TwilioCon, we talked a little bit about the API. So, there were a couple different groups that had, like, brought prizes. Like, for instance, Dropbox was there. Who else was there? There was a couple, like, quad rotors and stuff that people were off. I don't even know who all was presenting there.
It seemed like on the page that was talking about the, you know, informal little hackathon competition, there was like 12 groups or so that were sponsoring, and I think like most of them had a prize, was it?
Yeah. Right. Oh, right. Oh, that's right. There was all the different... Okay, right. So this is what it was. It was a... It looked like a little... it was a collection of logos. So there were a bunch of logos for companies that were involved in the event. And the logos were arranged in sort of a circle, so they basically, not like a outline of a circle, but they, you know, the entire area of a circle. So there were ones in the center, there's ones on the edges or whatever. And you could click on each logo, and it would take you to the website of that company. Then above that on the page, there was a list of companies that were offering prizes. So I, of course, am a I am a strategic winner. So what I did was I looked down the list of prizes and I just did a middle click to open all on the logos in the circle thing below to just open the pages of only the companies that were offering prizes. Because why would I compete in a hackathon to use someone's API that I'm not going to win anything for? Clearly. And there were two really cool ones. So Dropbox has just recently released their API. And this API, I am a huge fan of the Dropbox API. It lets you basically upload and download files. It's a real simple interface. Basically, it's the same as, you know, almost as if you were on a Linux machine. And the user has to say, yes, I grant access to my Dropbox or just a specific part of your Dropbox. And then you can just basically do your cloud-based storage stuff. The next app that I found was really cool was Pusher. And what Pusher lets you do is it lets you have basically lets you have sort of like an iOS notification, but for any of your apps anywhere. So you have, I think you register to a stream. So let's say you had your iPhone, your website, and I don't know, your Linux box all register for the same event stream. Then if your iPhone were to push up a notification, all three of those places would get basically an asynchronous like push notification with a little message. So you could do this for like a chat. You could do this for all different kinds of things.
So I found the Twilio Conference hackathon website with a list of prizes, and just an example of the prizes for the actual Twilio, you know, contest itself, because they were hosting it and, you know, they want people to use their product. So, of course, they're going to offer prizes. The first place was a MacBook Air. Second place was a Parrot AR drone, which I guess is this cool little
quad rotor helicopter
you can control with your iPhone. And then from the other companies, there's Apple gift cards, a branded kegerator, which is cool, so an actual like beer fridge kegerator, Amazon gift card, Bose headset, Jawbone Jambox. These are just examples. A couple iPads, and ooh, what about the Dropbox prize?
What was the Dropbox prize, Merrick?
It was a terabyte of Dropbox storage for life, bitches. So
wow,
why are we excited
about
this?
Really...
Because Ben, the PI to the motherfucking MP, stormed in and just won that contest, and he's a pimp like that.
So basically, I could really use a terabyte of Dropbox storage, and I fully have 1 terabyte of Dropbox storage. I could use it, and now I have it. 1,032.2 gigabytes, bitches!
It's awesome. And do you want to talk about what you did to win that?
So basically, I've been working on a web crawler, and my web crawler has an issue. The web crawler is distributed. I've called it the Hydra web crawler, because it's, you know, it's a multiple node web crawler. And this web crawler can run on multiple internet connections. So right now we could fire up one on my internet, on Merrick's internet, and on Sam's internet. And the way it works is that it eats up all the bandwidth at each node downloading web pages. It's just downloading the HTML and saving it to disk, right? The cool thing is, though, or the thing that sucks is, if I've now used 100% of my internet to download things, how am I going to then sync all of these three folders at my house, Merrick's house, and Sam's house together to the same place? And this was something that I had been working on, and as soon as I saw the Dropbox API, I was like, yes, this is the answer. Basically, how it works is after each web page is downloaded, it makes a call to the Dropbox API and just pushes it into a Dropbox folder. Which means if I run the crawler for an hour and then stop, the Dropbox kind of has time to catch up in the background, and eventually all of the files I've downloaded, I've crawled for that 1 hour, will appear in the same place, which is in my Dropbox, which is pretty cool to put it in the cloud like that. So the Dropbox API works with Python. It works with, I'm just looking at it right here, iOS, Android, and Ruby. So they pretty much covered all of the bases here, but I'll say, so basically the URL you guys need to go to, I don't know if I'm supposed to say this, but fuck it, it's https://www.dropbox.com/developers_beta, and that's with an S, developers with an S, /, or maybe start, or just developers beta, /. And if you go here, basically you can register Dropbox for developers, and it's only in the beta right now, but you guys really need to check this out, because the Python script took me about 3 or 4 minutes to get working. It was like a snap. It was just like done working. So my web crawler is actually written in C, so I had the problem of I can't really make API calls to Python, because that was the language I wanted to use. So I kind of was thinking about that for a while, but basically what I ended up doing was I took the example and I just rewrote the example a little bit so that the example will accept a file name on the command line, and then it'll just send that file name up to the cloud. Now, Sam is not really professed as a self-programmer, Sam, but I'm telling you, programming is all about copy and paste. It's all about taking the examples and copying and paste them.
Yeah, I think you once said that all you do is copy stuff and paste it into Notepad or something. Is that what you said?
So I took the example. The example lets you upload files, download files, whatever. And basically there's like a case statement that says do this, do this, do this, depending what they type in. So what I ended up doing was I just, what I would call hotwire the case statement. So basically I say, always go here. So I'm not deleting all the code. I'm not doing anything. I just change one or two lines, and then the case statement always goes to one place. Like, I would call that hotwiring. So I hotwired the case statement, and then I said, instead of taking a file name from the keyboard, I want you to take the file name from, you know, the arguments. Like, you know how you would say, like, you know, on, you know, you can call an exe, and then you can give it arguments afterwards, Sam?
Right.
So I just take the file name from those arguments afterwards. And that is all in Python. So what I was allowed to do is I just make a Linux system call and say, please execute this binary with this arguments, with these arguments, and then return to me and keep going. So that allows my C program to make calls to this Python binary. It doesn't matter if it was Python or any other language, because I'm making a system call. It's the same thing as if I were just like run it or double click it or whatever. And we fucking won, dude. And basically they said that I hit the API rate limit, which supposedly I heard today, I was talking to these guys today, they said it was insanely high and I still hit it. So that is why having a Hydro web crawler is pretty awesome.
Yeah, the Twilio conference was cool for some other reasons too. But at the same time, when you go to one of these things and you win like a for real prize, it's like all of a sudden that much more awesome.
So if you guys have been keeping track, I won iOS Dev Camp, I won Cloudy, I won TwilioCon, so we're 3-for-3 now.
I don't know if you've been paying attention or not, but I'm a pretty big deal, is what he's trying to tell you.
Thanks, Ron Burgundy, if that is who that was.
Oh, man. So the food, let's see, how the food at TwilioCon, it's tricky.
I would say 2 or 3. It's tricky, yeah.
Because
they ran out of pizza the first night.
Yeah, it's like they didn't realize the kind of supply they were going to need, so even though the food tasted good, there wasn't enough of, like, I guess, I don't know, the breakfast spread, I missed day one breakfast, but day two breakfast, there was enough of everything, but pizza night one, like, seriously, there's got to be, like, 150, 200 dudes in this room, minimum. And they bring
they
like 10 boxes
bad.
Of pizza.
They all smell
in.
Pretty bad, by the way.
And it's like, wait, what? 10 boxes of pizza for 150 dudes? So they had more delivered, but it wasn't enough fast enough where it was like, you know, all right, well, there might be enough food later. So, but they were good on drinks, and up until I think around 9 or 10 p.m., they had a open bar. Well, kind of an open bar. It was like a wedding bar where you can get like a few different types of beer or like one or two wines or something like that. And you would just tip the bartender, but free alcohol. I guess I'm being a little picky here. You know what can you
but
say?
The breakfast spread in the morning though was really good because they had like they had smoothies, they had cereal. Someone tweeted like Cheerios at TwilioCon. I'm stoked or something like that. No, it's Fruit Loops.
No, they had the little English muffin things too, which were delicious. Now that you remind me.
Dude, I hated those English muffin things. I thought they were fucking shit.
They were
thought it was poor quality bread, poor quality meat. I was not happy.
Just like with the meatballs today, you have what is it with
the meatballs? Were high quality, but I did not enjoy the taste. These were low quality. This is like fucking McDonald's shit.
Are you saying that America has no class?
Yes, I hate McDonald's.
Wow, I guess. Yeah, no, that's
yes,
fair.
I'm saying America has no taste.
Well,
that's what you're saying.
When it comes to freaking breakfast sandwiches, I'll agree with you.
But they had like fruit. They had lots of fruit, and they had unlimited Red Bull, and they had it was pretty good. So I'm gonna give it like a 2 or a 3. I'm not sure, but
yeah, you know. No. I mean, given the pizza and dessert logistics, we're gonna ding them for that. Everything else was decent, so I could see a 3 for overall.
And basically, Merrick helped me. Sam was there later, and the Dropbox guy said, give me the emails of your team. And I was like, podcast time. Woo-hoo! So I just gave all the emails of my podcast buddies. And combined, we have 3 terabytes. And I'm pretty sure that we have the biggest civilian Dropboxes ever. Obviously, the developers of Dropbox can set their Dropbox as large as they want. But as far as civilians are concerned, I'm pretty sure that we're kicking some ass.
Yeah, it's funny, too, because before I was like, yeah, Dropbox is kind of cool. I could see how I could use it and blah, blah, blah. And now that I have a terabyte, I'm like, oh, my God, Dropbox is so awesome. I'm going to build shit that does shit with API, and I'm going to fucking back up the moon to Dropbox and fucking win. So I'm stoked on that, and hopefully in a future podcast I can tell you some cool shit I did with their API. Who knows?
So I actually have a YouTube video where I describe my win, and it doesn't show me winning or anything, but it just shows kind of my project and my crawler running and stuff like that. And so I'll put that in the show notes.
Good news.
So we want to go to the next one? So the next one, if you're ready, was the HTML5 hackathon. And that was last week, and actually it was just me. No one else really attended. Basically, it was at the Eventbrite headquarters. So I got to check out the Eventbrite headquarters. It was pretty cool. I guess I'm going to be the only one talking for the next couple of minutes, but... Basically, they had a couple different prizes. There were prizes for using the Eventbrite API, and a couple different people came up with some cool different things with that. Actually, the guys from Bettable were there, Bettable being our favorite gambling service, and that was the reason that I was there, is because they invited me personally. And I ended up winning, again, 4 for 4, a prize from MongoLab. So in a bit, we're going to talk about Redis if we have some time, but MongoDB is another one of these new databases coming out, which are considered NoSQL. Basically, that means that they simplify the model, they make everything a lot simpler, and you end up getting a lot of performance out of it. So MongoLab is a cloud-hosted MongoDB database service, and they have some pretty cool things going for them. So Mongo is normally done over like TCP/IP connections, like a normal socket layer, you know, whatever, and you send your get your request back. But if you want to do that from the browser, it's a little bit harder. So what they've done is they've made a REST API that lets you get straight at your databases from the browser. So if you want to make a JSON request, it's just as easy as going to the right URL and having your API key set up properly, and you can get the data straight out of your database, which is so, so nice. So the project I ended up, I won third place, so not that exciting, but the project I ended up winning with was I took the web crawler, and what I ended up doing was for every web page that I crawled, I did a GPS lookup to find the GPS coordinates of the IP of that web server. And then what I did was I went to a Google Maps and I drew a line from the parent web server to all of the children. So all the links in the web page, I did a lookup and drew lines. And I was using the Google Maps API, which is actually really easy to use. So I took, once again, Sam, I took the Google Maps example, and on the example, they had a single line that was drawn. And basically, I just looked through it, and I saw how they drew a line. And instead of drawing the line from those two coordinates, I just put it in a for loop. Sam, you familiar with loops?
I am.
Yeah, maybe.
Soon he will be.
So I took a loop from all the outstanding data points, and I just plotted lines. And the demo, I don't really have a video of the demo or anything, but it came out pretty cool. As the crawler goes, the website refreshes every second. And so depending on how many web pages are crawling a second, you can see these lines just shooting across from the United States to, you know, Germany, back to back, to New York, to Texas, to whatever, all these different cool places. And I ended up winning. The food was pretty good. They had, I believe it was Thai food for lunch, and then it was a Chinese food for dinner. They had kind of like one of these open fridge setups because it was actually, the food, it was pretty close proximity because at Eventbrite, they had like their whole cubicles and offices or whatever, but this hackathon was in the Eventbrite kitchen. So the entire hackathon was operated from the kitchen. Not the kitchen, but, you know, the common, like the eating area, the dining commons, if you will. And so, you know, there wasn't any really issues with the food. I'd probably give it like a 3. You know, it was all right. They had soda, and they had there was no beer. Oh, there was no beer. Damn it. That's going to have to be like a 2.5 because, I mean, without the beer, I mean, I can't really get in the zone when I'm programming. So I don't – not so happy. But once again, I ended up staying up all night, which was kind of standard practice for hackathons, a little bit stressful. But, you know, in the end, it came out as a victory. That's about all I have to say about that.
There's an iPhone app that I used some time ago that basically did a graphical version of Tracert.
Right, Tracert.
Yeah, and it's kind of neat because you would run your Tracert on whatever IP, and then you could just see it dropping all sorts of pins all over the place. Pretty neat. your thing reminds me of that.
Nice.
So we've been reviewing these events in chronological order, and I was just reminded by Ben about an event I went to and was awesome and forgot about. So it's a little website, perhaps you've heard of it, called TechCrunch, and they review, you know, things that are happening in the high-tech world, and there's quite this personality and a media frenzy that's been occurring, whatever you want to call it, regards to Michael Arrington, which was like the lead guy at TechCrunch. And not to catch you up or bore you with those details, but you can look all that shit up online. So anyway, TechCrunch holds this event they call Disrupt. And it's where they bring together a lot of startups that, you know, they're either behind or funding, or you can pay to bring your, you know, like show off your startup at this event. And there are different levels of, you know, how much you want to pimp your stuff and how much it costs. But they had a over the weekend hackathon before the TechCrunch Disrupt SF, and that's for San Francisco, so Disrupt SF 2011. Before this event, they had a hackathon over the weekend, and I went to that, and I should have talked Ben and Sam into coming, but it was just one of those things where, you know, I forgot to or whatever, so I was flying solo on this one, much like Ben did at the HTML5 hackathon, and the food was decent. They actually did the quantity awesome. There was always tons of food and snacks, which was cool. So I'm gonna do the food 3, and there was an interesting snack company there pimping their energy snacks. So not like an energy drink, but they had energy snacks. They had these little bags of potato chips and trail mix that like had taurine and guarana and like other little, you know, Go Power stuff mixed in with it. So that was kind of cool, and you know, would help you stay up all night long mashing on the keyboard if need be. They also, you know, had the energy drinks too. And
was it a 24 hour hackathon?
Yeah, it was. This was a full
what?
Well, it was like a 20 hour. It wasn't a full day, but from kickoff to when you had to have your entries judged by the next morning, it was something like Friday afternoon till or
but
Saturday
did it run
afternoon till Sunday
all
morning.
Overnight.
I don't know the exact days, but all things considered, I think you had 21 hours to mash on the code. And
did it run overnight though?
Yes, it fully did, and you fully could stay there and
I'm
do
so
whatever
jealous.
You wanted. And people were setting up like, you know, sleeping bags. And what was cool is this event was held in a rather large hall, and it was free too, as is most of the events we attend. Some cost money, but we try to avoid those. So this was free to attend, as was most of the events we've attended. And there was enough companies here sponsoring this that there was cool stuff happening. Like, for instance, some of the companies had these little foam rockets that like had like a rubber band thing, so you could launch these little foam rockets like way across the hall. And it was like indoors of this rather large conference center, so there was all these little foam like projectiles just flying all the time, which was kind of random and fun. So they definitely, you know, there's no problem with quantity of food, and there's beer with dinner, which was cool too. And I was working on my little project called, I'll just give you guys the brief, and we can jump into the detail later, like, you know, when we've got to talk about some other shit. But the service I'm working on is called Text My Queue, and, you know, text like a text message, my queue, your queue, like as in your Netflix queue, where you have your list of movies. And
or
so my
is
service,
it your Quickster clue now?
Say Quickster? Again?
Quickster?
Yeah, well, more on that later. My service would allow you to send a text message to me, my service, with a movie title in it. Say your favorite movie is Terminator 3. That's your favorite movie. So you text that to my service, and then all of a sudden, you get options back to add it to your Netflix queue. So it's for people with short attention span who like watching movies and want to add shit to their Netflix queue. It's also going to be a queue management tool, which it is somewhat right now. I've built a rough version of it, and it is live at textmyqueue.com. If anybody wants to give feedback, awesome.
That's TextMyQueue.
Thank you. Yes, the correct spelling of QUEUE.com. I did get the other domain name, so you can actually spell Q pretty retarded and still get to my website.
Nice.
So GoDaddy's happy about that because I'm sending them tons of money. But
and you're happy
so that's,
because
that's
you can't
brief
spell.
On my service, and I definitely like to talk more about it later, just based on learning experiences as I was going and some of the stuff that's happening in the code base. So we'll get into that down the road. But back to the distraction depth Zero. TechCrunch hackathon was awesome. Why? Not so much because it was a 20-hour hackathon or because they had cool prizes, which they did, but because I didn't take Ben, I didn't fucking win, apparently, which is horseshit. So fuck that shit. But anyway, what was cool is everyone who presented and entered in the hackathon and presented got a free ticket. Two free tickets per team. If you were solo like me, you only got one. To the actual Disrupt SF event, which was the following week. This is a 3-day thing. 2 full days and then like a third half day. And they charge $3,000 per ticket, which is like,
oh,
what?
My God.
So I was stoked on that, and I was totally like, all right, well, I'm going. I got a free ticket. So it was actually a good show they put on. No way in hell I'd ever pay 3 G's to go there, but I guess what happens is a lot of people who represent companies go, and their companies, you know,
like
it gets
VCs
expensed.
Go and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, so it's, you know, one of the higher level, you know, professional events, and I say higher level just like higher expense, but they actually did have lots of, you know, venture capital type, you know, famous Silicon Valley type people there talking about this and that and funding, and there was good shit going on. Ashton Kutcher came and talked a little bit about him being a VC and his new show, Two and a Half Men, and blah, blah, blah. So it was interesting to see him speak. So that I would recommend, if TechCrunch is something you can get to and go to that hackathon, go do it just so you can go to the event and see what that's like. It was a good show. I'm sure there's some other cool stuff I'm forgetting, but they also webcast the whole thing, and you can still watch the videos of the whole thing. This is Disrupt, not the hackathon. You can actually get this from TechCrunch's website. So if you're into entrepreneuring or startups, or you just want to find out what's going on in Silicon Valley and, you know, see what the hell these people do or what this event's like, you can get all that on TechCrunch's website. And I enjoyed that event. So there was that one, and that actually happened before TwilioCon or this HTML5 thing. The dates, I'm sure, are somewhere out there in case you're randomly curious, but I know they do it in New York also, and maybe some other big city. So New York and San Francisco that I know of, but possibly other cities. So I liked it. 3 out of 5 on the food. Free tickets were awesome, and next time I'm taking Ben so I can win some shit. God damn it.
That's right, motherfucker. So Sam, tell me about Lean Startup.
Oh yeah, you didn't get to go to that. Merrick and I went to the, it's more of a book signing, I suppose. We had the author of that book, The Lean
Which
Startup.
Which is Eric Ries, R-I-E-S.
Yes.
And his book is called The Lean Startup. And on the title, on the front page it says, or on the cover it says, How Today's Entrepreneurs Use Continuous Innovation to Create Radically Successful Businesses.
Yeah. Eric has a whole bunch of interesting things. I was mostly interested in going so I could get my questions answered about patents, and so I was really lucky. I got he only let like 2 or 3 people speak,
yeah,
and ask questions, and I was the last person who got to ask a question before he cut off like the line of people behind me. So I feel really lucky about that. I was surprised. I thought he was going to let everybody speak. But
can you tell us about your question without kind of giving away what your underlying thing is, if you want?
Yeah, I'll ask my question. He mentioned in during his presentation that one of the reasons why Dropbox was successful was that the CEO made a video of himself portraying the service working exactly the way he wanted it to work, and then pushed that video out to the tech community in specific forms, and at the same time had the Dropbox website with a, you know, a beta queue running. And so people got really excited about seeing...
Was it like a mock-up video? Like it wasn't working at
that
point?
It was basically like, you know, just looking as though it would work. But there was no actual working code.
And Dropbox, as a service, did not exist. He had not written one line of code.
So he just made a mock-up video, released it in certain channels, and then said, sign up now on the beta.
Right. And that was the guy we were talking to today, Martin. He said that there was like 90,000 people queued up at one point before they started, you know, allowing a lot of people in. And so obviously that worked. And my question for Eric was, should, you know, at the time that Dropbox was making that service, there wasn't really anything else like that, since it was from a technical standpoint rather difficult to do, and still is, even though there's a lot of competition now. But should
should they have taken out a patent prior to releasing that video, or does it not matter? Should they just push forward with it regardless, or, you know, how important is that? And basically Eric said that in so many words, I'm not an attorney, but sometimes you just have to get a patent. He said that patents are an innovation tax, you know, horribly outdated, but that was basically what I expected. Merrick, what do you think?
Yeah, it's a tricky issue. With my, you know, limited experience, you can file a provisional patent to protect yourself depending on what you're building. And, you know, this is very, you know, the reason I had a paranoid phase when I was worried about, you know, TextMyQ, and I was like, oh God, what if, you know, someone else builds one right away? Or what if, you know, Netflix pumps one out, you know, I'm screwed. And which is technically still true, but at the same time, it's been a while, so I'm not nearly as worried about it anymore. But the area, if you were trying to protect a web service, for instance, you would think you'd be going after a software patent, but that is a whole ball of
mess.
You know, I've not researched it all, but I've heard it's bad news, and I've also recently heard that people are trying to, like, abolish software patents and get
But to be fair, though, those people are, like, the Linux community, like, the hackers, like, the people that are
open source,
feet on the ground, open source guys, and people that are concerned with with patent trolls, like, for instance, Microsoft and Apple, who basically are just suing each other, suing Google, suing Motorola over these patents which say things like, you know, notification bar which slides in from the left. Like, stuff like that, which is, like, so basic that it's really retarded that you're patenting it. But that being said, those lawsuits are happening, and those patents, you know, those things are being honored. So it is, I mean, there's something to be said for that.
Yeah, right. So it's interesting. So, you know, obviously that does stifle innovation, and it's too bad that shit's going down. And, you know, that just seriously, it backs up the whole system. Not to mention the patent system itself is backed up, which is why if you want to get a patent right now, you have to hire the shit out of an expensive patent attorney, and you have to, you know, put in a fair amount of money and time to patent something. Not to say certain things don't need protection, but when we're talking about software or a web startup, what you're actually looking at is patenting a business method. And this is not a off-the-shelf, let's do it, run with it thing either. There is some controversy around if a business method can or cannot be patented. So when I was last worried about it and doing research, I found out that, you know, this is something that patent system is dealing with right now, and they are looking at these things on a case-by-case basis. But what you do in the interim period is file for provisional patent, and that says, I started working on this date, and you get like a year window to develop your idea, and within that year you have to file for a full patent, which is when you got to bring out the time and money. And if you decide it's worth it, go for it. And if not, you know, I think a provisional is only like a few hundred dollars to file, so it's not the end of the world. But that still locks you in, though,
if someone else tries to file that same patent, right? If you were provisional, that's the whole point, is that then you have the option to then within that year say, oh, well, we were first, this is our provisional patent, and, you know, we filed first, right?
Exactly. Correct. And depending on the country you're in and, you know, patent laws, trademark copyright laws, this all varies country by country, but sometimes you just building something, if you have a record of when you started working on it, that can actually be used. I've heard that used in cases saying, we were first, we were doing this first. So this does vary between patents, copyrights, and trademarks. So it depends on what you're doing, what you're trying to protect. It's kind of a complex system, unfortunately. But, you know, there's obviously real-life situations where people get zucked. And I'm spelling that with a Z.
Zucked as in not fucked, but zucked.
Zuckerberg.
Like, I'm going to zuck you or Zuckerberg you.
As in, if you've not seen the movie The Social Network, watch and see what happens to the Winklevi twins.
Yep.
Which is funny. Not to even take sides, it's just an example of what happens when people are on
money's
different pages
involved.
Regarding a startup.
So the USPTO is really backed up. It takes about 3 to 4 years to actually get your patent, and so that whole time you have that patent pending period. And during that time, you don't have any protection against someone else just taking your whole, whatever it is your idea is you have on QVC, or, or what else would you have?
Well, so that means they could build their thing, even though you have patent pending, they could build it and they could be selling for those 2 years until your patent went through. And if they said your patent is legit, then you could then sue them, right, for back history, right, at that point, right?
Correct, unless they, you know, they've pulled their thing off the market or bankrupt it, you know.
Whatever,
the thing is, people can make, it's a risky thing, but a lot of businesses will do that. They'll copy it for, you know, 2 or 3 years, and then suddenly the patents eventually go through, and then they pull all that stuff off the market and maybe get sued, maybe not, depends. But and one thing you said, Merrick, today that was very true is that I'm, because of my legal background, I'm steeped in legal stuff. And that heavily
legalese. I said you're steeped in legalese and you have law and patents on the brain, and you know, I'm a little bit paranoid myself, but thankfully I've not been exposed to the amount of legal shenanigans you have, so you know, that's, I definitely understand where you're coming from, and you know, hopefully we can help you break out of that shell.
That'd be good. Thanks, Merrick.
Great. So we want to talk about what we went to today, guys?
Today was cool. It was a random event, not necessarily a public event. Uh-oh,
no, this was invite only.
Now
we are VIP because because I keep winning all these hackathons. We've been invited to two things now, one of which was VIP. And this was basically a speaker. It was high-performance HTML. And this was held at the Dropbox headquarters, which was pretty sweet. I am actually searching for who was speaking. I have
Steve
it.
Steve Saunders
is the name of the gentleman. And he's been a performance guy his whole life, like as in high performance code. And I believe most of the stuff he's been doing is related to the internet and, you know, the kind of transactions that happen between servers and clients and the whole chain, really. Like, if you think you're testing performance of a server by looking at one metric, you're crazy, because there's actually a whole chain of events that happens between, you know, a user on one end and you know, the server, and a whole complex, not that complex, but you know, there's lots of events to measure, which I didn't realize until I went and saw this.
So there were a lot of different things. I'll kind of give you guys a rundown, but what we're going to do is we're going to put a link to his presentation PDF or PowerPoint, whatever, in the show notes. But basically, when you load the page, let's say you have an external JavaScript file or you have an inline JavaScript file, depending on your browser, depending on how things rendering, the browser may or may not stop. When it sees a JavaScript inline, it may stop, start rendering and compiling all the JavaScript, and then resume with the page after it's done with that. So if you have an inline JavaScript that's pretty complicated, you're going to stop rendering the rest of your page until that JavaScript has done being compiled. There were some issues he discussed with how CSS works. So if you have, what was it, if you have CSS, if you have JavaScript and then CSS, it doesn't know if the JavaScript's going to be changing the DOM or whatever, so it'll wait for the JavaScript to all the way execute before it actually loads in that CSS. And so he's been starting this project, which is called the HTTP Archive. Now, raise your hands out there if you guys are familiar with the Internet Archive and the Wayback Machine. Great. So some of you are interested. So the Internet Archive basically lets you see the HTML status of a web page, you know, back in the years. So you could look at old versions of Yahoo and things like that. But they don't let you know what the server response was, you know, if they were using, I don't know, he said a couple other things. Basically, they don't let you know how the server served out the web page. You get the text, but it's being served by the Internet Archive. It's not being served out by the server. So you don't know what the page load times were. You don't know how the external images were interacting and blah, blah, blah. So he started this new project called the HTTP Archive, and this tracks how the web is built, how the web is serviced. And basically it's the same exact idea as the Wayback Machine, except for the fact that you're saving the statistics of how the server served out the web page. Now, if you go to httparchive.org and you come to websites, and for instance, we just type in Dropbox here because that was the example that we used. You can take a look and you can see what the let's load it here. Basically what you want to do is you want to look at the HTTP waterfall. And this is a really interesting measurement. Basically this has let's see, how do I describe this? It's a list of the items that the page is loading. That's, you know, listed from top to bottom. And then along the right, there is a little bar, which basically, starting from about the middle of the page, extending to the right of the page, the middle of the page is 0 milliseconds, and the right of the page is, I guess, the ending load time. So these little bars, for each item that's listed vertical, these little bars are drawn, which show how long it took to load the item, and when the item started to load and finished loading. And what you'd like is you'd like basically a very clean, you'd like all the items to be loading very quickly after each other. But if I'm looking at Dropbox right now, I see that the page waits almost an entire second after loading Dropbox mini.javascript before it loads all the GIFs, the images, and the PNGs on the web page. So there's, if you have to be looking at this to really understand what I'm saying, but if they were able to basically push all of the items to be loading at the same time, their page would load a lot faster. And so Steve Sanders basically talked about how he has been performance guy and what this means. And one of the high overviews of this presentation is that faster means more visitors, more clicks, more money. You guys want to talk about that a little bit, Merrick? Maybe what he was saying about how the faster the page loads, what that means?
Even though you're not paying attention, a very interesting thing he pointed out was a page load time measured even in milliseconds can affect subconsciously how a user reacts to a service. And his example, I forget which one they tested it with 2 seconds, but a very large website.
It was Bing and then Google.
Yeah, Bing. So Bing, they did a test on a small batch of users where they introduced intentional delays to results just to see how the users would react. And they cranked it all the way up in increments to 2 seconds or 2,000 milliseconds. And then they would track these users over time and find out, you know, how this affected. And there was, I don't remember all the statistics off the top of my head. It's in the notes. But it's kind of surprising, actually how concrete of changes were introduced into these users' browsing habits by this delay. So it was a little shocking to me. I wouldn't have guessed that. Just a 2 second delay changing someone's browsing habits for weeks, even months to come after that. So that was very interesting to me, and it is something to consider if you're building anything where you're going to have significant user experience. If you're building any kind of website where people are going to be interacting with your service or website for more than just one click, then you want to be concerned with these metrics, and you want to make sure your page loads fast, or else you will be losing users. It's like that.
Right. Simple. It also became an issue when Google officially announced that they were going to make page load time relevant to the page rank.
Right. So he said there were 200 signals which describe how well your page rank, what your page rank is. And he said that even though your load time is only one of 200 signals, it's something that's not that hard, or it's something you can work on really easy. It's something you can control. You can't control incoming links to your website, but you can control how fast your website loads. So it's just something that gives you an edge and makes your page load faster and makes your page rank better.
Right.
Just in case anybody's wondering why, it was so quiet and boring right there, is I was texting my my ex-girlfriend, and Ben was picking his nose, and I don't know what the fuck Sam was doing.
Dude, I was texting your ex-girlfriend.
Oh my god, you're both texting my ex-girlfriend.
Redis? Ben?
Wait, we're not done with this thing. So
wait a minute.
Yeah, wait a minute, Sam. Just fucking hold your fucking horses, dude.
Hey, wait. Mm-hmm. Speaking of Sam, you don't happen to be on a tablet right now, do you?
Not right this very moment.
No. Just go back to the fucking Steve Saunders, dude.
I think it's Saunders. Saunders. A tree falls on a fat chick in the woods, and if no one's there, does it make a sound? If no one's there, does it make a Saunders? So the Sounders, like, that's his name, Sounders. I'm sure if you Google it, you can find him. Or if you search for high-performance HTML5, Steve Sounders, you can find it that way.
So this was a private event at Dropbox, and actually I met someone there who works there who I randomly know through, like, my roommate's ex-girlfriend, which is super random, but she was there. And the food was all right. Like, they had beer and they had some cheese and they had the quiche. So we were promised pizza and beer. Okay. So we get there and there's quiche and cheese. And I'm like, where's my fucking pizza?
Well, yeah, but to their credit, the quiche was actually pretty good.
It was a good quiche. I agree. It's a good quiche. Sam's comment was, do you know how fucking hard it is to make a quiche, dude?
You look so visibly disappointed, I had to say something.
I don't cook shit for a reason.
Okay, well, it is very difficult to make quiche, but...
Isn't that what women are for? Pardon me, all my female listeners, if there are any. I'm just kidding. Totally being sexist for our entertainment, and you're awesome, and we love your food.
Yes, please.
Wow, that's an amazing disclaimer.
I know, right?
I don't afford anybody that. Disclaimer.
So, good talk. The quiche was hard to cook. It tasted good.
So afterwards, I brought out the pizza.
Yeah, Steve Sounders put on an awesome show. He really knows what he's talking about. Like, if you are remotely interested in metrics as far as how long it takes some shit to happen online between computers, check this guy's stuff out. He does good work.
Definitely. And then they ended up bringing in pizza afterwards. And what do we think about that pizza? It was cold, first off.
The quantity was great. There was tons of pizza. They did have a very well-stocked beverage case, a Dropbox beverage case. It was like four doors wide. Almost everything you could want to drink was there, right? So that was cool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But the pizza was cold, though.
No, it was warm.
It was fucking cold. It was cold. Pizza's either steaming hot or it's cold. There's no warm. You can't say it was warm.
The difference between sticking your dick in a warm body and a cold body is pretty significant and could be, you know, get you in some trouble, so...
Okay, all right, so if she's just recently died, then it's okay to bone down?
Yeah, pretty much. You don't know yet. You could totally claim, you know...
I had no idea. Okay.
What's the legalese for that, Sam?
Oh, Jesus Christ, Merrick.
Are we looking at minutes? And if it's been minutes, is it, like, not that big a deal? Or
I was originally, like, going to agree with you, but now I'm going to have to go with Ben. It's going to be...
I'm totally kidding. Again, to all my female listeners, necrophilia is not a thing I'm into. Do not worry. I keep saying that like there's a female listener. Isn't that weird?
There are. There's one. We got a donation from Whitney. That sounds like a female listener to me, so...
Well, yeah. Whitney, I don't mean to offend you.
Oh my God. That's funny.
So yeah, the warm pizza, I still thought it was yummy. I'm going with a three.
I'm going to say three and a half
because of how the creativity and the effort they put into their pre-show spread. It's not like they just got some fucking, you know, crackers and dumped them in a bowl. They actually put a little effort into that, so...
There was, like, a little cheese plate that had fucking pomegranate on it, right, Sam?
That's fancy shit, dude.
Yeah.
So three and a half for the Dropbox talk, or sorry, Drop Talks is what they're going to call these things. Drop Talks. Apparently they're going to try to keep doing them. This was the first one. They have a cool little headquarters in San Francisco, and apparently they're maxed out there. They're going to be moving to new offices in the coming year, and they're hopefully taking over the world because Dropbox is awesome, and we love them, and we're going to use their APIs to help them take over the world.
It was pretty cool. We got to talk to some of the employees there. We got to talk to employee number 23, who was the 23rd person to join the company.
Very cool guy. We don't remember
his name, but he was number 23.
I am bad with names, so I feel bad about that, but we did talk with him, and we talked with Martin later. I'm sorry. I don't know why we remember Martin's name. We don't remember number 23's name. They're both cool guys, and they're both, you know, very knowledgeable about what they do at Dropbox and excited to work for the company. And I like... interacting with, you know, these smaller companies gets me motivated and excited because you see it's like a success story, you know, that Dropbox started out with, you know, one or two
guys.
Y Combinator.
So let's talk about their funding. So they started out with Y Combinator, which is like 50 grand, right?
20 grand, which is not that big a deal. Why Y Combinator is so huge and important is they are extremely well connected in Silicon Valley, and you get mentoring in the Y Combinator startup.
Right, so after they kick money down your throat, then they give you mentors. If you said, I want to meet with Steve Jobs, they might make it happen. Like, they can hook up the meetings.
Seriously.
So they can get your shit, like, you know, on the news wire, basically, and get people notified or whatever.
And anyone who gets YC funded, you're automatically going to be a thing online, and people are like, oh, shit, I'll check that out. And there's on their website, you'll notice two very rich and somewhat famous people have agreed that any Y Combinator-funded startup has the option for another 150 grand seed funding from them, no questions asked.
So they're Russian, right?
Yeah.
I believe they're Russian.
One of the crazy rich Russian dude who got rich. I was just reading about him the other day, and it's funny because there's like this rich Russian dude that's like full of scandal, and it's actually a different Russian guy. This one seems legit, so he's a cool guy. Lives in Santa Clara. More money than I can even describe to you. It's measured in the billions. It's some big number. So him and someone else rich are like, yeah, if you want another 150 Gs, no problem. So that's pretty cool. So if you have a legitimate startup idea and you want to vet it quickly and easily, there is a, I think twice a year they run these YC rounds or incubator rounds, whatever they call them, and you fill out the form on their website, ycombinator.com, and they ask you a bunch of questions, and you know, you submit it. If you get approved, you get to fly out to California and work with them for 4 months, I believe. And they'll give you 20 G's, you know, to cover your expenses and whatever. You can use the money for whatever you want. And in exchange, they take 7% of your startup, and all that is fine and dandy, but seriously, the connections they have, that is where it really
happens. That's worth the 7%. Like, 20 grand, like, you could get 20 grand from a couple of your friends.
Seriously.
Like, you could kind of run, like, I'm going to give $1,000, I'm going to want $1,000 from each of my friends, and you'll get, you know, whatever, but, you know, the 7%, I feel like that's kind of a lot, especially if you have a lot of, like, three or four co-founders, like, that's going to slice up your pie pretty good, but the fact that they give you the connections, I mean, to me, that makes it worth it, so.
Yeah, no, that is full, it's without a question, I mean, aside from arguing the percentage, the Silicon Valley connections at Y Combinator, Paul Graham is one of the main guys there, even though there's other Y Combinator people. He's the media personality, so I saw him speak at TechCrunch, and he fully is like aware of, you know, what startups are going through, and he is like one of the main mentors there, and they have these little dinners or whatever, where not only just the current round of Y Combinator projects, but all previous Y Combinator people are invited to come hang out. And, you know, you seriously, the connections are priceless. You cannot put a price on meeting and being plugged into this type of environment. So if you have a legitimate startup idea, hit up Y Combinator, come out, and once you're on the road to becoming a bajillionaire, just remember how you got there and remember the little guys at Port Forward Podcast.
So yeah, definitely don't forget us. And then, so we were talking about the Dropbox funding, so then they also got, it was like a $1 million in the next round from someone, and then they got $6 million after that.
Yeah,
and we were talking with Martin, he was like, yeah, we're doing incredibly well for such little funding. Or maybe it was the other guy that said, it was number 23 that said,
yeah,
that.
Yeah, 23.
And then it was hilarious because I was like, yeah, $7.5 million is, you know, that's a lot.
It's not really going to cut it then.
For my thing, I think I'd be just fine. $7.5 million.
I'm sorry, that's not nearly enough money for me.
Yeah.
No, seriously, a Gulfstream G650, I think, is somewhere between 50 and 60 million. That's before you set up the interior.
And that's before the packages. That's no internal stripper pole or anything else like that.
No,
that's
like,
just lean.
If you want whale penis leather on the seats, that shit's going to be money, all right?
Yeah, it's expensive. Okay, so we're done talking about Dropbox, I feel. We have all the ratings on the food. I think that we're going to talk about... So, well, let's just talk a little bit about the podcast, a little bit of business here. So you guys may have noticed the podcast release schedule has been slowed down a little bit. That's mostly because I am the only person that knows how to edit this piece of shit. I mean, this wonderful podcast. And it takes me a lot of time. And I've kind of started up... I've started doing my master's at San Jose State, so that's a lot of work. I've kind of hooked up with a startup, which I won't even discuss, which is also a lot of work. And I'm working for myself as well as working full-time, so I'm doing a lot of separate things. But basically, recently I've kind of got the startup bug, and I don't really know what the future podcasts are going to look like. We definitely will be releasing them probably less than once a week, which we apologize for, but we're going to put them out as fast as we can. But I kind of have a feeling that we're going to be switching this podcast more to a startup technical podcast, not just a tech podcast, not just like a hacker podcast, but like, how can you make a legit startup? How can you get funding? What are the cool things you can do? I know Merrick's down. Are you down, Sam?
Yeah, no, I've been living it the past, fairly seriously, the past 6 months, and I've been researching it, you know, even up to 18 months back. And the book that set it off was The 4-Hour Work Week by Tim Ferriss, Timothy Ferriss. Awesome author, very down-to-earth guy, and an entertaining author, too. So that kicked it off for me about 2 years ago. Ever since then, you know, I've just been doing every which way thing I can and, you know, trying to innovate. And I love building shit, and that's what got me into programming. Well, I've always had ideas for physical products, but I realized you can prototype and build a service and a product digitally much cheaper. You know, if you learn to code,
faster,
you can do it for essentially free, you know, just your time and experimentation.
And electricity
and stuff.
A couple
of the books
so.
We've mentioned recently are worth their weight in something very valuable. Take your pick. Pubic
printer,
hairs,
printer
for instance,
ink.
If you're from
printer ink.
Borat's country, which I can't think of right now. Eric Rice,
Kazakhstan.
The Lean Startup, it talks about how you can, you know, test your idea for next to nothing and find out if it's going to be a success or not. Like, I'm running with TextMyQ already, but I don't know if that's going to be a success or not. Like, seriously,
you might need to iterate. You might need to pivot.
I think it's going to be a useful service, but at the same time, I have not read, you know, Running Lean, which is another book, or the one by Eric Rice, The Lean Startup. I'm like 4 chapters deep in Eric's book, and it's full of good information, but
Right, so you might need to do what's called a pivot, which means turning with 1 foot stuck in the ground. So you might need to turn your business model from where you were in a completely new direction.
And to jump back to what we were talking about before, we're not necessarily like just changing everything and we're not going to talk about high-tech stuff anymore. We're still going to cover anything that's intriguing or interesting in high-tech. And if there's anything you guys are like, oh shit, what's the deal with this? You know, we're totally down to talk about it. At any point in time, if you ever like, what the hell are you guys talking about? Seriously, shoot us a super quick email. Feedback is how we
Twitter,
know if
whatever.
It's cool or not. That's how we know. So hit us up. Let us know.
Right. So, quick reference, by the way, printer ink is the most expensive liquid on the planet, so just going to go ahead and say that, by the way.
Well, did that have to do with your printing out black pages thought?
No, that had to do with you saying measure these books in Take Your Pick.
Oh,
and then
I
didn't hear what you said about the Borat. What did you say about Borat thing?
Borat. Pubic hairs are worth something to I can't remember the name of the country. It was like, you know, some Eastern Bloc European shithole.
Wait, what was the word again?
Watch like one of our listeners is from there and they're pissed now. What do you mean the word?
You said it twice and I keep talking when you say it. Something X is worth a lot in Borat's country.
Oh, pubic hairs.
Okay, gotcha. Mm-hmm. Okay. I kind of thought that's what you were saying, but I kept talking. Now the listeners are pissed.
Cool. Good talk.
So, that being said, that's kind of the business end of the podcast. We would love making this podcast. We're still going to try and talk about all the tech stuff, but maybe with a little bit of a startup flavor, kind of how can you use this to get your business going.
Definitely. If there's anything we want to do, it's make millions of dollars, and if there's anything you guys want to do, is do that too. And if not,
give us some of your millions.
Know what
as
you
well.
Want, but I hope you can get there by listening to our podcast either way.
So now I'd like to switch to our last topic, which is a technical topic. So those of you who have been tired with the startup stuff, we're going to talk about Redis. No S.
Red what?
REDIS.
Oh. Where did you read it?
Well, I read it on your name tag, which was stuck on your notebook, which you forgot about, and then want to tell that story real quick?
Seriously, like 2 years ago, or at least a year ago, I went to this pretty cool little IEEE is this large organization of engineers that I got hooked up with while I was in school, and they host all these different random things, and I got an email about an intellectual property talk that they were this guy was giving, this guy who was very wise in the ways of patents and the patent system, and that's the knowledge I mentioned earlier. That's some of that came from there, and you know, that was back in my paranoid phase. And at this talk, someone mentioned Redis, and I wrote it on my name tag because it sounded cool. And what I wrote was Redis. There's a little squiggly arrow. It says super awesome data store. So this sticker has been on my notebook for like a year and a half, and I completely forgot about it, even though I touched it a retarded amount of times. And then the other day, Ben's like, hey, Redis. I'm like, that sounds familiar.
So basically, it's a NoSQL data store. So if you guys are familiar with SQL, as far as I'm concerned, SQL is a huge pain in the ass. So if you have your website, usually the way I make my website is I start with phpMyAdmin, and I go in and I design my SQL schema. So what the or my MySQL schema. And so what the schema is basically it's the name of all the tables, and then it's, you know, this table has an integer and then two strings and then a date or whatever. So maybe maybe it's your social security number, your name, your address, and then your date of birth. And if you want to update the schema, then you either have to update your code and the schema at the same time. I've actually heard of people keeping revisions on the schema, because if your source code revision doesn't match the schema revision, then your code's just going to puke. So Redis is kind of like a refreshing breath in terms of the whole MySQL thing. So it's called NoSQL because there's no schema, really. The schema is kind of defined by... it's kind of like as soon as you create an object, it just works. So there's a couple URLs I want you guys to check out here. The first is try.redis-db.com. Or you can just Google for try Redis, and that's R-E-D-I-S with one D. And what this brings up is a really great little command line. Basically lets you type in commands and see what Redis would give you. So if you just type in tutorial as the first thing, it says, tells you about Redis. It says Redis is what's called a key value store. It's also referred to as a NoSQL database. The essence of a key value store is the ability to store some data called a value inside a key. This data can later be retrieved only if we know the exact key used to store it. We can then use the set command to store blah blah blah, and then just keep going on with the tutorial. And so with MySQL, I guess I don't really know, I guess how complicated it is to insert and do searches and things like that. But with Redis, they're very clear about what's called the time complexity of each operation. A little bit of a sidetrack. Time complexity is, let's say you have a collection of 5 objects. If you want to print them all out, it's going to take you basically 5 times some overhead to print them all out. So that would be a time complexity of n, because there's n objects and you're printing them out. Each one has to be printed out at, you know, one time, so that's n. If you were going to check every single object against every single other object, so there's 5 objects and you have to basically check against the other 4, or, you know, against the other 5, that would be, you would be doing 5 times 5 operations to be able to check them all against each other. So that's called big O of n squared. So when you're solving problems, usually you want to stay away from n squared. You want to stay away from n. If you can, you want to get to big O of 1. So the page that I want to show you here is redis.io/commands. That's commands plural. And basically this page here shows you all the different data types and the time complexity of all the things that Redis supports. So Redis supports keys, strings, hashes, lists, sets, sorted sets, and then transactions. Now, I'm using Redis for my web crawler, and it is pretty amazing. Basically, I'm using the set data type. So when I'm adding things into my set, the time complexity is big O of 1, which is pretty amazing. It means that no matter how many URLs I have in my collection of URLs, each time I'm adding a URL, it only takes basically it's instant. Big O of 1 basically means instant. The next thing that my web crawler does is it pops things out of the set. The time complexity for a set pop is, once again, big O of 1. So Redis is kind of like a, like I said, it's like a refreshing breath of you know, no SQL. It basically lets you really, really quickly take care of your data. And if you know about hashes and lists and sets, which I won't really talk about, you basically can choose the right data type and just do all your commands using that data type and get all the benefits out of it.
So the notation you're mentioning, you described it to me the other day, and it made some sense then, and now I actually understand it a little better. Is there, is this named, this notation, or is that just what it's called, big O of N?
So that's called time complexity, and that was something that we learned in university. When you take algorithms class, they talk about, you know, like no, like, oh god, like graph theory and all these different things. So like, it's called time complexity, basically, big
gotcha.
O. And it's kind of like, it's kind of interesting the way you talk about it. So let's say we're talking about instructions, okay? If you were talking about that simple example where there's five things in a list or whatever, let's say if you wanted to just print the first thing in the list, let's say it takes two instructions. Let's say it takes two instructions. I know that's totally unrealistic, but whatever. You might think that would be big O of two or whatever. Let's say it takes two instruction times the number of things that you're printing out. Basically, the idea is that as you are working with larger and larger and larger data sets, if it takes two instructions plus n items to print out, if n is a million, then it's two plus a million, which is basically the same thing as a million. So basically, any constant terms in your equation, you basically just cross them out. So if you're looking at an equation and you say, this is how many instructions it takes for me to do with this many items in my data set, well, if you set the items to a million, all the other terms in your equation get really small. So you basically think of things as, well, when the data gets really big, kind of what's it approximately going to be? So I don't know if that makes sense, but basically you just cross out, it's all in terms of n. So if you ended up solving it down and you said, oh, well, it's 2n, in reality, that's just the same thing as n. Even though it's 2n, it's really just n. I guess I'm not doing a good job of explaining myself here, but...
I think I follow you, but at the same time, the Redis example is good because that's, you know, for instance, when you said you're going to pop something and that's just, that was...
One.
That O of one, right? That's an indiscriminate pop, right? It's not like you're looking for something in the list.
Right. It's just say, give me one thing in the list. I don't care what it is.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing is you want to say, can you please tell me if this is already in the list? Once again, that's big O of one. Doesn't matter how many things you have in the list, if you know exactly the key, you say, is this in the list? It'll tell you instantly.
That's cool. That's kind of impressive to me without knowing how it works.
Yeah, it's doing hashing, which is, we can talk about hashes if you guys want, but definitely not this show.
Okay. I like it. So let's see, are we good on topics here?
Sam, any comments about Redis?
No, other than I thought it was really neat the way you implemented it with the web crawler.
Yeah.
But I don't have any uses for it myself just yet.
One of the reasons Redis is so fast is because it's an in-RAM database. So one of the downsides is that if your data set is larger than 4 gigs or larger than, you know, 16 or whatever 20 gigs of that your server has, it gets really slow. There's ways you can deal with that. There's things you can do. But basically, the way they're able to keep it fucking blazing fast is they keep it all in RAM. And I don't know what the stats are, but I think they're allowed to... They get up to something like a million transactions a second.
Wow.
Like, they are a fucking fast database. Like, it's epic fast.
That's crazy.
And so what a lot of people will do is they'll use Redis for, like, session logins and things like that because it's in RAM, so it's not that big. But you might be getting a lot of people accessing their session token, like, you know, their login credentials, all that stuff. You just keep that in Redis. That's a huge offload from MySQL that you don't have to deal with. Basically, it allows you to save for the things that are really simple and make sense that need to be done real fast. You can save those things from MySQL. And if your power goes out or you lose all the data or whatever, you don't care because your server is going to reboot and people will log in again. It doesn't matter.
Interesting.
Sure. Yeah.
So, what else? Is that it?
I mean, yeah, I think that's a pretty good podcast. What do you guys think?
It's not too shabby.
Let us know, listeners, if there's something you want to tell us. It is packets@portforwardpodcast.com.
Or on Twitter, we are portfwdpodcast.nothing, not .com or anything. Just portfwdpodcast.
So tweet us, mail us, whatever, send us a care package. We won't complain. We'll even give you a
whatever
shout out.
You do, don't send us a fax. I don't want to see another fax, a fax machine. Don't page me, whatever you do. I don't want any pages.
No carrier pigeons either.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Telegrams or whatever you think you're trying to do.
Great. Well, thank you guys so much for listening, and have a nice night.
Definitely.
We'll see you next time.
Bye.